seizes with rage. When next he opens his eyes, he sees Jazz stab out with a high kick, taking out the last hut slave. The neck snaps. The slave drops. Jazz Amari backpedals, sawing at the rope with her own horns. Amari! He growls, trying to stand. She cuts through the rope.
Please don't hurt me, Mercurial. Please don't take me to Boss Cutie.
She makes a gesture at him with her free hands, the backs of each finger swiped along her cheeks as her upper lip twists into a sneer. He assumes it's a rude gesture. Then she finds one of the bolt holes leading up through the hut's temple. She clambers her way up through the space and is gone. Her head hurts. Bad. The horns on her head are bone. Breaking them off meant breaking her bones. Slamming the side of her skull against the unforgiving stone wall of her cell and snapping them off one by one was no easy feat. After each attempt, she had to sit. She tried not to throw up. Once she passed out, and then it was back up at it again. Wham! 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 Blood slicking the wall. Her brain doing dizzy loops. Until she had three of her thorn-like horns in the flat of her palm. Three keys. She'd had one actual key hidden there, a lockpick concealed in a fake horn. But the hut slaves found it and took it away. Which left her with one choice. Break off the horns. They were her way out. And she needs it too. Quick as anything. Because this vicious diversion paid an unexpected bounty. She knows where Ray Sloan is. She saw her, here in the temple, working with Nima the Hutt, going together on some kind of expedition. She has to get back to Nora, and fast. She had no idea who was coming for her, but it being mercurial both pleases her greatly and worries her deeply. Swift is no fool. And he said something about bringing a crew. Him? Working with a team? Mercurial doesn't play well with others.
These are strange days indeed.
Whoever they are, they're now a part of her plan. They came here somehow. A ship, she assumes, if he has a crew with him. And if he has a ship, then that ship has clearance codes. Clearance codes mean they can take to the air, and the Empire won't shoot them down on sight. It won't be an advantage they can use forever, but it's something. First, though, she has to get to that ship. And then she has to take it. The tunnels here in Nima's temple are a worm-eaten labyrinth. She thinks she's headed in the right direction, but suddenly the tunnel curves back on itself and goes the other way. Most of the tunnels look the same. Every time she believes she's figured it out, the tunnels prove her wrong. And she worries suddenly that she's going over the same area again and again. Is this mark a scuff mark from her boot? Fear assails her.
I could die in here. I could get lost and starve to death.
Or they'll come for her. She stops crawling and takes a moment just to listen, turning her ear to the tunnel ahead. Sounds. Scraping. Murmuring. Coming closer. Jazz hunkers down and lies in wait as the sounds grow louder. It's them. Nima's mind-wiped acolytes. Can they smell her? Do the hut slaves know their way through this maze? From an intersecting tunnel, one appears. Pale face. Sharpened teeth. The slave's mouth widens in alarm, mad eyes flickering, and he comes at her fast, scurrying like an animal, teeth snapping at the air. Clack, clack, clack. She kicks out with a boot, catching him in the mouth. Teeth shatter, and her foe gags on them. A little voice inside her says,
"He's a slave. He doesn't know what he's doing. Don't kill him."
But it's too late for him. There's nothing there. No mind. No rational thought. just pure feral zeal. Jazz has to do what she's gotta do. But even taking that time to worry about it distracts her. Hands come at her from behind. They close around her throat and drag her backward. The back of her skull slams into the stone. Nausea rises in her, threatening to take her insides and send them outside, nearly overwhelming her as the second hot slave draws her back through the tunnels. She kicks her legs and paws fruitlessly at the stone, trying to get her moorings, working hard as hell not to be wrenched away by this gabbling, mind-wiped mutant. But it's no use. Instead of resisting, she decides to go with it. Like a swimmer, she pulls herself in the same direction the hut freak is dragging her. It gives her just enough momentum to overtake him and crash into him. They bowl over. She fights into position. He howls as she crunches an elbow into his trachea. The howl is cut short, stopped by a squeaky gurgle. Jazz doesn't stop and wait. It's time to move again. And so she does, finding an adjacent channel and wriggling through. Anytime she finds a new borehole, she takes it.
Just keep going. Don't stop. Don't vomit.
She'll find something. Some way out. Some way forward. Another sound halts her progress. This time, the sound isn't coming closer. It's distant. Someone yelling. It's him. It's Swift. She gets a small thrill from hearing the panic in his voice. She focuses on that sound, zeroing in on the direction. That's the way she heads now, through tunnels that corkscrew, where the hut slaves have carved mad icons of their mistress Nima. And then, from an adjoining tunnel, she feels it. A faint current of air. With it, a smell. Metal. Kesium. Ozone. The smell of a starship. That means a hangar bay or landing pad. A new sound arises, too. This sound is musical and discordant in equal measure. And now she knows she's close, because as they dragged her through Nima's temple, they pulled her through the hut's throne room, a cathedral-like area shot through with holes that hummed and howled like a wind instrument, like a musical organ formed of ancient stone. Whether that was designed intentionally, lunatic music to appease the slug, or is simply a natural effect, Jazz doesn't know and doesn't care. It means the way out. It means freedom. She follows the air and the strange music and starship stink that it brings. Ahead, a smooth borehole dropping down awaits. The bounty hunter drags herself along it on her belly. She peers through the space, and sure enough, there she sees the prize. A shuttle, by the looks of it. An older model Corellian ship. Flat, short wings. Big, tubby engine. At the fore hangs a blunt nose cone.
That's my way out.
One problem. It's got a guard. The rest of Swift's crew, whoever they are, don't seem to be here. They're probably off looking for her. Jazz isn't a gambler, but she'd bet credits that's what Swift was yelling about. One guard, though? She can handle it. From here, she spies the broad, rimmed hat of a Cayuso.
Familiar. Too familiar. It can't be.
As he turns, looking around the room, she spies his face and recognizes the bounty hunter who used to run with her aunt's crew.
Embo. It's him. Even now, she misses him sometimes.
He was quiet and spoke only in his native tongue. But she took the time as a child to learn his language. And as a result, they became close. Like family, in a way. John Burrell reminds her a bit of Embo. Silent, deadly, but sweet, too. Hard to get close to. But once you do, you see how good he can be. Of course, if this is really him, then what? Does he know he's here to hunt her? Does his loyalty side with the job or with her? And if he sides with the job, mercy. The Cayuso are capable fighters. Embo is older now, but if she had to lay credits down, she'd bet he hasn't lost a step. She must tread carefully. Jazz centers herself. She's still dizzy, but she'll have to push past. With a fluid, silent movement, she slips through the hole and hangs there, her fingers finding a narrow, smooth groove in the stone to help hold her. Her feet dangle. Below, Embo paces near the shuttle's ramp. He's a good way down, but she can handle the jump as long as she doesn't go straight to the ground. Instead, she swings herself forward and... Jazz is in midair, arms out, legs crouching as she lands atop the shuttle. Whoomp! She lands as quietly as she can, but still, it makes a noise even as she ducks and rolls. There's no time to waste as she quickly sidles forward, ducking behind one of the shuttle's fins and flattening herself against it. Footsteps. A grunt. Embo is looking.
If I can just sneak past him, this gets a whole lot easier.
Jazz whips down along the aft side, jumping from one engine booster to the next until she's on the ground and creeping up alongside the ship. Maybe, just maybe, if she can dart inside, Embo won't even see her. Then she can fire up the ship and... A tall shape lurches into the space in front of her, perfectly silent. A bowcaster points at her, a crossbow big enough to take her head clean off her shoulders at this range. Embo has found her. Orange eyes glow in the dim half-dark of the temple hangar. His breastplate is scarred up, the gold long since worn off, and the red Cayuso battle shirt is ragged at the hem.
Embo!
She says, startled. The bowcaster doesn't waver. He tilts his head, and in his Cayuso tongue says,
Old friend, it is you.
She licks her lips, looking around. Embo could kill her. He could end it for her right now. He's gone up against bounty hunters, pirates, Jedi, Sith, and he's either triumphed or survived to fight another day. She swallows a hard lump and feels her palms sweat.
It's good to see you again, Embo. It's, been a while. Merrick around?
He passed away some years ago.
Merrick, Embo's pet Anuba. A vicious beast to Embo's enemies, but to her, the long-muzzled hound was ever the diligent cuddle bug. Never failing to roll over and seize a belly-scratching opportunity as the young girl giggled.
I'm sorry to hear that. He was a good hound.
He was.
So, you're working with the crew again?
Her two hearts hammer inside her chest, beating so fast it's like cannon fire underneath the mantle of her breastbone.
If I move, he'll end me.
I always work with a crew. It is the Cayuso way to not be alone.
But swift, huh? I wouldn't have thought.
To that, Embo says nothing. He only shrugs. She asks,
You always know you were hunting me?
I did.
How's this going to end then, Embo?
From behind the bounty hunter, the faraway cry of another voice she recognizes. The blunt workman accent of another bounty hunter Sugi worked with once upon a time. Dengar. His presence here is a surprise. Swift is really bringing the history with this crew. Sugi always hated Dengar. Everybody always hated Dengar. Of course, they hate Swift, too.
Back to the ship! She came this way!
Dengar says. She can't see that old salt. Not yet. But he'll be here soon.
Come on, come on, come on. Embo,
she says.
I know you have debts. You and Sugi. You two helped people. You did the right thing. And I know that upset the wrong people. It cost you. I have her debts too.
She realizes now the deal for the Cayuso is probably simple. Embo's slate will be wiped clean if he brings in Jazz. Debt for debt. Credit for credit. She starts to hear Dengar now, closing in.
Sugi always did what was right, even though she didn't admit it. And you were loyal to her. I'm trying to do something good here, too. The right thing. Even if it's not the easy thing. Even if it makes the wrong people mad. Even if it costs me. So, I need you to not bring me in. And I need that ship.
Embo seems to consider this.
I am old,
he says.
And Merrick always liked you.
He lifts the bowcaster and steps away from the ship. Her path is clear. She lets out a breath.
I won't forget this, Embo.
As you say, child.
She wants to do more. Even just stand here and talk to him. She regrets suddenly having lost touch with him all these years. But there's no time for that. Already as she runs toward the ramp, she spies that old bastard Dengar trotting up, his long-barreled rifle swung up by his hip.
Jace, don't you dare run!
His cannon rifle goes off. She winces as a bolt shrieks over her shoulder. Nearly falling, she manages to hurry up the ramp, slamming the button closed behind her. It begins to ascend as she dives into the cockpit, opens the gunnery panel, and sets the shuttle's nose cone turret to drop. As she warms the engines, the turret begins barking fire through the hangar. Dengar dives behind a rock formation just as the turret blasts a small crater where he was standing only moments before. Time to get out of here. Time to find Nora.
Interlude. Tatooine.
Bring him out!
Two Red Key Raiders, Yimug the Gron, Guiska the Rodian, drag the man in all too familiar Mandalorian armor out into the center of so-called Freetown. The man staggers forward, his hands behind his back. Yimug throws him to the ground. Guiska kicks him in the tailbone so that his helmeted head pitches forward into the sand. Lorgan Movellan steps up. All around, the Red Key Raiders applaud and hoot and catcall. They line the walls all around Freetown, raising blasters in the air, some firing them. The people of this town are huddled together down here in the center. Some lie dead, serving as lessons to the others. The rest wait with weapons against their heads to remind them to remain docile, lest they, too, find their brains cooking on the sand. Movellan looks down his long, crooked nose and scowls at Cobb Vanth. He lifts his lip into a sneer and hawks phlegm into his mouth, then spits. It spatters against the Mandalorian helmet.
You don't deserve that armor,
Lorgan says, his voice a hiss, like sand against sand. For good measure, he kicks out with a cobbled tread boot, kicking Vanth in the head so hard, the so-called mayor of Freetown goes down like a sack of mock spelt.
Is it even real Mandalorian armor? Looks like something hammered out on a swindler's forge. Besides, wearing a strong man's armor doesn't change how weak you are. Take his helmet off!
Guiska and Yimug work in tandem, unscrewing the helmet off Vanth's head with an unceremonious twist. With that done, Lorgan now can look into the eyes of the man who has been giving him so much trouble.
You've been like a grit of sand in my undercarriage,
Lorgan says, baring his teeth.
Cobb Vanth, noble lawman, sheriff and mayor, and all-around thorn in my hind end.
He shrugs.
I'm not impressed.
Gotta give me some credit,
Vanth says, gravel grinding in his voice.
I was enough of a pain in the rear end to bring you out here.
Who are you, anyway?
Just a man trying to do right.
What's your game? What do you want? Not power, not money. Surely this little cult of personality is paying off. Is it women? Maybe the armor has given you delusions of grandeur.
I want freedom.
Oh, so that's it. He grabs the man's head, pushing it forward hard enough that Vanth's teeth clack as his chin slams into his own chest. There, on the back of Vanth's neck, a symbol formed out of scar tissue, like a primitive star with a series of dots and hashes. An owner's mark.
You were a slave.
Sure, that's the story we can tell.
A playful flash glints in Vanth's eye, and it only enrages Movellan further. He was nobody, and now he's very much somebody. A slave turned sheriff. A ghost into a man. With Jabba gone and the huts in disarray, and further, with the Empire and its slave tax having disappeared once the second Death Star went kaboom, it makes sense that the slave class here on Tatooine would break apart. Its slaves, once given a measure of freedom, would not go so easily back to the cage. But who owned him? And why risk his neck for the others?
Let me ask you a question,
Cobb says.
I'll allow it. Ask. Though no promises you'll enjoy my answer.
What do you want with this place anyway? Tatooine is a sandbox. Water's scarce. It's hot and dry as a dead man's mouth. Why not leave it alone? Why not leave its people alone?
Lorgan takes a long draw of air through his bent nose. The stink of the man, and really of all these Freetowners, is nearly overpowering. Sweat slick and oily.
If you must know, the Huts consider this world vital for reasons I care not at all to comprehend. What I do know is that Tatooine has its resources. Dilarium oil, Silicax oxalate, but its so-called people are the most vital resource of them all. Some of the galaxy's legacy breeding stock is here. And we wouldn't want to diminish those slave bloodlines.
He says this last bit as a dig against Vanth.
Your failure here today will see all these people back in chains. You too! Your time in the wilderness is over!
It's not my time that's ending,
Vanth says.
You'll see.
Lorgan considers rebutting the man yet again. But what is the point? It doesn't matter. He's taken the town. He's got the man in the mask. Red Key is ascendant, both here and across the galaxy. Now, only one more thing.
I find it strange you thought your ploy could work,
Lorgan says.
I mean, really. Just because you have a hut slug doesn't mean you can install it on the dais and control Tatooine. That's what this really is, isn't it? You don't want freedom for people. You see this place as a resource, just as I do. Just as I see you as a resource. Now I'm going to take that hut slug, and I'm going to sell it back to the huts. You will be dead by then.
He thrusts up a finger, and two more of his raiders come forward. The wattle-necked Ithorian, Vaum, and that broad-shouldered brute woman, Trainus. They come dragging a ripped red tarp, a tarp that squirms and squeals as the slug inside it tries to escape. Behind them, on a chain, comes a fat-bellied man in a long leather hood. His shirtless skin grimy with some sort of foul grease. Slug slime, Movellan thinks. Another twirl of the finger, and they unroll the tarp. The hut spawn slug, young, barely an adolescent, rolls out. Small arms flailing, craterous mouth crying in fear and pain. The hooded man hurries to its side, cooing to it, shushing it, stroking its ooze-slick brow.
Shh, shh,
the Beastmaster says. In a sing-songy voice, he adds,
Everything will be okay. Everything will be fine, baby Borgo.
Borgo? They've gone and named the thing. He looks to Vanth one last time and says,
The hut is ours. These people will all be slaves. You picked the wrong hill of sand to die on.
So did you,
Cobb says through bloody teeth. Then a moment passes between Cobb and the Beastmaster. Vanth gives a small nod and a wink. The Beastmaster returns the nod and begins stroking under the hut's chin, whispering something. Lorgan barks an order to Trainus, and she moves fast, clubbing the Beastmaster in the head with an open fist. The man bleats and falls, clutching his now bleeding head. The hut spawn lifts its head to the sky. Its slit mouth opens, and its tongue wiggles out. Tastes the air. And then it howls. What comes from its whole bodied throat is a shrieking, ear-bleeding dirge. There's a stir at the margins, Movellin's own people suddenly turning and pointing beyond the walls of the town. He cannot see what they see, but when they begin firing their blasters, he knows something's gone wrong. Then comes a sound, a terrible howl, followed by a mad battle cry. Red Key raiders begin falling from the walls as blasts from outside take them out. Movellin turns, his finger in a wild lasso gesture, to Vaughn and the others. He says,
Go! Go find out what that is!
They hurry off, but he doesn't have to wait for their answer. The front gates of the town bash open. A massive bantha, bigger than anything Movellin's ever seen, crashes through the opening. It has one eye scarred over, and its fur is matted with filth and wound, with bones and rusted gears. Atop it is one of the Tuscans, those feral desert raiders who have given Red Key so many problems over the last year. This Tuscan is, like the Bantha, bigger than all his cohorts. Huge, bristling shoulders hold up a head wrapped with ragged fabric and plastered with massive black goggles, gleaming in the sun. Red Key raiders attack the Bantha, but the Tuscan maneuvers atop the beast like a circus performer, swooping down, breaking one Red Key neck with his crude stick weapon, then scrambling underneath the Bantha and up on the other, before unslinging a cycler rifle and firing a trio of shots, all of which find a home in the heads and chests of Movellin's men. Then the Tuscan is back in the shaggy beast's saddle once again. Other Tuscan brutes begin clambering up over the walls, swarming the Red Key. And yet the Freetowners are untouched. They knew. This isn't a random attack. Lorgan wheels on Vanth. The sheriff is standing there. Behind him, the cuffs lie in the sand. The Beastmaster, looking gleeful, like a pleased baby, stands there with a Magna driver, having clearly helped remove the shackles. Lorgan is fast, but not fast enough. Even as he brings his blaster up, Vanth backhands him hard. He goes down. A boot finds his wrist pressing down hard enough that his fingers uncoil from the pistol's grip. The shadow of the lawman falls onto him, and he stares up at the sun's edged silhouette. All around him, the bark and gargle of Tuscan battle cries.
Funny thing, Vanth says. The Tuscans consider this place sacred. They don't like slavers any more than we do. We cut them a deal. We give them water. They leave us alone. They like that we have a hut, too. Earns us a bit of respect. And my friend here, Malakili, he procured for them something real special. A pearl from a crate dragon's belly. That afforded us the last piece of the puzzle. Their protection. Though I think they might have done it for us anyway. They don't like you syndicate types out here.
Lorgan tries to crab walk backward, but Vanth presses down on his wrist hard enough to hear the bones start to grind. He cries out,
"You don't know what you're doing, Vanth! You're an idiot, playing a game against gods! You stole that suit, thinking you can fill it! You stole a hut, thinking you can raise it to the dais! You'll never succeed here! My masters will come! They'll kill you! They'll wipe this place off the map!"
Vanth kneels down on his chest.
"What you think I stole? I say I earned. You think I'm just some slave, and that's one part of the story. But you don't know the rest. What I've seen, who I was before, and I know my time is short. I've poked the monster, and now it is awake. I'll die in service to this town, and maybe this town will die with me. But we won't be the last, not by a long shot. The next ones who come, they'll know me. They'll know my time. They'll carry the flags of Freetown, even if Freetown is gone. And one day, Tatooine is free, even if me and my swindler's forge armor and my little town have been claimed once more by the sands. Now hold still. I gotta carve a message into your face before I send you on your way."
Lorgan cries out as Vanth reaches for him. Chapter 14. The Skittermouse does what the Skittermouse does. It skitters. Across the desert, its little paws tickle the dead land as it runs. Tiny claws make tiny sounds. Ticka, 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 ticka. This Skittermouse is like the other Skittermice here on Jakku. Small enough to never be seen. Skinny enough to fit through a bit of pipe or tubing. And curious enough to look for food in the strangest of places. Currently, though, it is not seeking food. It wants to build a nest, a burrow. Its last one was taken over by a pole snake, and the mouse wants no part of that serpent. A Skittermouse burrow is a peculiar thing. The critter tends to find a hole in the stone or sand, and it lines its future home with bits of detritus scavenged from, well, anywhere and everywhere. A dead man in the desert will remain only so long before the Skittermice come and take whatever the carrion birds have gnawed. Leather from a boot, tufts of hair from the top of the scalp, fingernails. Stories have been told of nomads in the desert seeing a bubbling fountain oasis in the distance, only to come upon it and find the fountain is really an undulating pile of Skittermice. Scare them and they scatter, revealing a dead man reduced to little more than bone. Once the mouse has its burrow material, the creature begins to look for a larger object with which to plug its burrow to keep out other animals, such as, say, pole snakes. Presently, this Skittermouse has found a bit of wire. Wire is good. Wire can be bent with the mouse's tiny scissor teeth and turned into a little place to curl up and sleep, or a place for babies to do the same. But these wires are stubborn. They just won't move. Tug, tug, tug. Nothing. They're stuck, anchored tightly to a bulky hunk of metal. At least a hunk of metal bulky by the Skittermouse's standards. Ah, but what is this? A black metal thing. Cylindrical and already hanging off the side, it hums and sparks. This would make a most excellent burrow plug, would it not? The mouse gives up on the wires and moves now to this other thing, and the Skittermouse squishes itself between the black object and the metal bulk to which it's attached. The mouse suffers a sharp spark,
But for a good burrow plug, it will endure. It must endure.
The mouse squeaks as it noses the black piece free.
The mouse gets behind it, and with its delicate front paws, begins to roll the cylinder into the dark, hoping very hard that Ripperaptors or Vorwarka do not spy it doing the industrious work of merely surviving on this heartless, desiccated planet. For a time, all is still after the mouse leaves. Then, two lights flicker and go bright as moons. Slowly, surely, something comes back to life. This is Mr. Bones. The B-1 battle droid's memory matrix remembers many things. It remembers darkness. It remembers marching with its skeletal brethren in perfect lockstep, advancing on a village surrounded by green grasses, innocent people huddling there in the night. Innocent people who would not survive, thanks to this battalion of battle droids. It remembers spears of light, green and blue, cutting through the night and taking those metal men apart, one after the other after the other. Showers of sparks, searing magma lines of melted metal. It remembers an incongruous memory, too. Those beams of light held in its own hands. Not two hands, but four. Spinning about. It remembers... No, he remembers dancing the lale, singing for children, a program to amuse them, a program to please. It remembers triple sixes, a designation perhaps? Once, more darkness. This matrix is not one thing. It knows that. Bones is many minds and many lives. Some known, others hidden. Protocol programs, martial arts, combat strategies, puppetry, child rearing. They are fitted together by an eager, if inelegant, hand. The hand of a clever boy who needed a friend. Bones recalls him, too. Friend. Boy. Temin.
Master!
Though the boy is not his master because of how he is programmed, Temin is the droid's master because Bones knows the value of gratitude. Bones has lived many lives. All of them, except this one, are now ended. To be given life again, even as a patchwork quilt of identities, is a special thing. Rare and precious. And Bones knows that Temin is his maker. And so Temin is his master. It is only fair. Bones, above all else, cares about fairness, about loyalty, about friendship. His friend's face swims into his matrix mind. Embers of data in the darkness bloom like mechanical synapses. And Bones remembers Temin, panicked, giving him one last set of commands.
Launch and get to Jakku! Find Mom! Protect Mom!
Mom. Mother. Temin's mother.
Nora!
That is her, there in the dark. A newer, fresher image hits the droid's memory banks, like a concussive explosion. The image of blaster bolts clumsily dissecting him. Bones struggles to extend his matrix mind outward to his limbs, but none of them respond. Diagnostic checks cascade through him, and all of them report back.
Destruction!
All four limbs are detached and unresponsive. The droid's head, too, is partly detached. Its socket lies ruptured, but the metal skull remains connected to the torso by a telescoping cable. Woe darkens the matrix mind. Despair is not merely a human condition. Droids know the doom of existence and the end of things. And Bones worry suddenly, a deep, hungry worry, like a slick-walled pit one cannot escape from, a pit where even light is swallowed whole. He worries that he is dead, that he will not be able to fulfill his mission,
that the life his maker and master gave him has been squandered, ended now on the floor of this desert, near to the maker's own mother. The droid wills this to be untrue. Bones struggles against the fear that all his lives have led to this one worthless moment. But the restraining bolt that the trooper put on him, his diagnostics return and inform him that though his limbs are gone, so too is the lock. And then, in that revelation, a new memory surfaces, or rather, resurfaces. That memory brings with it three letters, A-R-M. Three letters that stand for three words, Autonomic Repair Mode.
Yes!
Bones is often getting into trouble, but the anatomical framework of a battle droid is quite simple. And so begins a self-repair routine. The cable connecting the droid's head to his torso suddenly retracts. And the socket, though damaged, telescopes open and once more embraces the stem of the B1's neck. Bones shifts his head down. His serrated beak digs into the dirt and cinches shut, moving him forward. He does this again and again. Each time it moves his frame forward by a few centimeters. It is slow and arduous, but it is progress. When he closes in on the nearest arm, he again digs the front end of his Raptor skull robot head into the ground. But instead of moving it up and down, he swoops it from side to side. Servos whine and grind. Again, it is enough to move the body to the right, centimeter by centimeter, until the torso taps the disconnected arm waiting there. ARM. Autonomic repair mode. The socket at the side of the torso thrums as it magnetizes. The arm judders on the ground, twitching as if suddenly and independently alive. It slides swiftly toward the body. Ball joins with socket. Metal claw clips fix it in place. Bone sends a ping down the length of the limb. Fingers move. The arm bends.
I have an arm again!
That arm is a vital tool that allows the droid to, like a dead thing reanimating to life, lift himself up off the ground, where he sees his other three limbs, two legs, one arm. He begins to reassemble himself, piece by piece, appendage by appendage, buzz and click. Durasteel talons pin wires inside joints. The droid readjusts a few bent rib bones. His hand functions as a wrench, enough to tighten his spine, but not enough to fix the bowing, bent posture. The left arm is not fully functional. The right leg isn't fully functional either. External repairs will be needed. But the droid now stands in the dark by Nora's cage. This is Mr. Bones. In the blackness of the Jakku night, Nora stirs. Her eyes bolt open. Something's off. Something's wrong. No, something has changed. She swallows, and it's like choking back broken blast glass. Everything feels dried out. And when she blinks, the grit is only ground deeper into her eye. She winces, reaching out, pulling herself to standing. The shape of the droid's parts in disarray is gone. Bones? They must have come for him and taken him away after she fell unconscious. Once more, she feels dreadfully alone. Out there in the darkness, someone screams. That scream is cut in half. Moments later, something rolls out from behind the Kesium rig wells. Something that tumbles up to her cage with a helmet. White, mostly, though striated with finger marks of Jakku dust. It belongs, or belonged, to a stormtrooper. Blood soaks the sand beneath it. Out there, another piercing scream. Blaster fire fills the air just after, lighting up the dark. Something moves in the shadows, and Nora presses her face against the cage to see two more stormtroopers running toward the shape. They disappear behind the Kesium well, and that's the last Nora sees of them. But she hears their cries, their bleats of pain. Now, from that direction comes someone else. Efni, the officer. He staggers forward, falling to one knee. The momentum bounces him back up to running. He's shirtless and sweat-slick, a white cloth swaddled around his brow. In his hand hangs a small blaster. He fires it behind him as he runs. He screams!
No! Get away! Get away from me, you monster!
He is prey, and his predator reveals itself. The battle droid moves in herky-jerky fits and starts. Bones is broken. Nora can see that much. His right leg is slow and wobbles at the joint every time it touches down. His left arm, blade extended, convulses even as the other arm remains steady, pointing its weapon. Efni's shots go wide, missing the droid by a considerable margin. He's running toward her cage. He'll be alongside it. She growls, scooping up a handful of sand and dirt in her open palm. And as he comes past, panicked, his mouth wide, his eyes wider, she flings the debris into his face. He cries out, clawing at himself. It stops long enough for Bones to catch up. Efni swivels, pointing the blaster. It's too late. The droid's blade cuts that arm off, and it thuds against the sand. Then Bones does to him what he did to Bones. One piece after the next, until Efni is just a pile of himself, sitting outside her metal cage. Bones swipes his vibroblade downward, buzzing through the lock on Nora's cage. The door swings open.
I have performed violence.
Yes, you have, Nora says.
Found you.
You sure did. Thank you. And thank you, Tim, for building him. Her strange, cackling, dancing, knife-slicing savior. We have to go now, Bones, or we're both dead.
Roger, Roger!
Chapter 15. The days of Counselor Gallius Rax are busy. Busier than even he anticipated. For the act of running an empire is a complicated feat, and he can only delegate so much. Some things require his hand. Many things do, in fact. And it is vital that he remain the one in control. In the morning, everything is administrative. He sits at a desk under a tent atop the roof of the main building. This vantage point allows him to gaze out over their base here in the shadow of Carbon Ridge on Jakku. From here, he can see the yield of his efforts laid bare. The data on his screen is brought to life as his empire grows to power. All-terrain armored transports march the perimeter. A line of AT-STs wait on the left. Ranks of TIE fighters wait on the right. And above, the ghosts of Star Destroyers, ready to drop from the sky and slice the enemy in twain like an executioner's blade. Day by day, the Empire grows. The weakness from within is cut out, like a soft, overripe part of the fruit sliced free and left on the floor. And the strong are summoned. They come here. They come to his testing ground. They come to his home. He draws a deep, centering breath, as he is wont to do. In that breath, he smells the scents of the planet on which he was raised. The smell of sun-warmed stone. The stink of sand. A heady whiff of something dead. It dries out the inside of his nose. The rest of him is that way, too. The moisture wicked free from his insides. All of the Empire is hardening. A fatty cut of meat cured into a bitter, leathery strip that has no purpose but to sustain. Sometimes he stops and looks in a mirror. Even he, who has kept up a rigorous physical regimen since he left this planet, looks tightened, stripped down, worn away. The transformation is a pleasing one.
I am metal, hammered into a blade.
As he does this, he hums to himself an ancient madrigal called Treachery and Countenance, a favorite of Palpatine's. Soon he is done regarding himself and his empire. He goes then and meets with his inner council. The general, Old Man Borum, the architect of the new stormtrooper program, Brendel Hux, the propagandist, Ferrik Obdur, and by hologram, Grand Moff Rand. Rax tells them that war is coming.
It's inevitable,
he explains almost dismissively.
We've seen now one rebel ship enter our space, barely managing to escape. Not long after, we detected a probe droid and a scout ship hunting us from the next sector. We've all seen Mothma's precious little speech, though I'm told she is bound in the torpid politics of the New Republic. I assure you, the battle is coming.
Coming slowly,
Borum says. And he's right. Rax wonders why that is. He's been assuring his council that the attack from the New Republic is imminent, and it should have been. But the days pass, and no attack has come. At first he worried that the Republic had a different strategy in mind, one he could not foresee. But now he suspects the reality is all the duller. They've gone timid. The New Republic is not a military entity. It is one of democracy. And it is painfully naive to think that democracy can work on a galactic scale. It is a very bad idea to expect a starship piloted by 1,000 monkey lizards to do anything but drive itself straight into the sun. Borum harumphs and crosses his arms.
I grow impatient. We can stand on alert for only so long. It wearies the men. It tests the soul.
My soul is indeed tested, Hodnar Borum. Rand, ever the taut pragmatist, says,
Let them arrive to the battle as slow as they would like. It gives us more time to bolster our numbers. With each day we see new ships join us. Just today, the veterans of Ryloth joined us in the Star Destroyer Diligent.
The messaging of our occupation here,
Obdur starts to say, but Rax cuts him off with a hissing shush. Obdur is an admirable lout, and truly Rax appreciates the power of propaganda. It is a necessary and theatrical component of what they do, and Rax loves nothing more than he loves theater. But Obdur's function dwindles. There is no more message. The value of propaganda is nearly zero, unless it could be used to taunt the New Republic into attacking. No, that would be too bold on the face of it. A magic trick is best performed when the audience doesn't know it's a trick at all. It is decided. He will have Obdur killed. It's no great loss. Obdur was a staunch ally of Sloane, and look how she turned out. So disappointing. Ending him must be done quietly, though. Rax will not bloody his own hands. Not in this. Perhaps this is a test for Hux's new recruits. Speaking of Hux, the man looks worried. As usual, his broad shoulders curl inward. His posture has been wretched of late. This world is having its effect on him. And admittedly, Rax has been making inordinate demands of the man and his talents. Thing is, Gallius needs Hux. Not just now, but for what comes later. He must be preserved in sanity and in body. It may be time to confide in the man more completely. Of course, that went poorly with Sloane. A conundrum. One that will have to wait. For now, a different matter calls. One that demands he bloody his hands. Rax leaves them before the meeting is over. He heads downstairs, past the prefab training facility, where troopers gather and battle, encircled by their mates and cheered on by bloodthirsty officers. Betting is fast and furious. Their training is more brutal now. Survivalist, animalistic, as fits this vicious world. He has no time to watch them maul one another. Rax heads deeper still. It's cooler down here in the sub-level. Pipes and conduits line the hallways, circumnavigating the base's necessary mechanisms. He winds through the hallways and finds the door. The room beyond is mostly just storage of unimportant things, uniforms and manuals mostly, both elements of a more refined empire, an empire that cannot endure. In this room, a very old man waits. His hands are bound behind his back. His knees touch the floor, like he's praying. How appropriate. Anchorite Kolob, Rax says. The man lifts his head, his eyes narrowing to tired slits as he stares through the half-dark of the room. Even from here, Rax can see how old he has become. Everything looks pinched and puckered. Deep lines and liver-dark blotches mark his face, his neck, his hands.
Who is that? Who are you?
The voice is trembling and cracked.
You don't remember me, Rax says.
Should I?
Is your mind weakening, or am I merely that forgettable?
The anchorite sighs.
My mind is flint sharp. It is capable of seeing all the suffering of the waking world, just as it is sure to remember the Eremite's precepts on torment.
Don't. I do not require your spiritual lectures. I require only that you see me. Do you know me?
Nay!
But Kolob's eyes widen and focus. His mouth moves to form a smile as the memory forms. And then, appropriately, the smile falls away.
Ah, yes, the boy who left. The boy at the margins. Galley, is that you?
It is, Kolob.
The man's shoulders sag.
It's been you all along.
Pardon?
You've been the one stealing our children.
A small smile grows on Rax's face. And why would you say that?
Because you did it then, too. As a boy, you wooed the other children away from the orphanage. Brev, Narwhal, Katina, they became wayward as you were wayward. Wild and rebellious.
No, not rebellious. I merely found purpose away from your foolish faith. And the children found that purpose, too.
And what became of them, Galley?
I killed them, to keep a secret. They fulfilled their purpose.
And why are you stealing children now? It isn't your Imperials coming for them. It's thugs and hunters and scavs coming for them in the night. But it's your hand I see directing them. Why hide it?
Why hide it indeed? I am taking the children because they too will serve a purpose for me. They will be the first.
The first what?
But that, Rax will not answer. Behind him, someone emerges from the shadows of the hallway. A man in a red mask, pointed and demonic, cast out of metal and fixed with hell-black rivets. That man is Yup Tashu. Once advisor to Emperor Palpatine, and now an advisor to Counselor Rax. Tashu says,
"The Anchorite's faith has ties to the Force, to the light side. A 1,000 years ago, the Anchorites of Jakku bound themselves to the Jedi. But now, the dark side prevails.
Tashu bows his head and hands wrap.